This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Good morning. It's Tuesday. It's 7 a.m. Like the man said, this is Teachers Talk Radio, and I am Tabitha McIntosh. Coming up, we're looking at teachers with invisible disabilities, the challenges of running a classroom, keeping up with your workload, and managing your life with a chronic illness, an autoimmune condition, or other hidden disability. And Dr. Pam Jarvis will be joining us shortly to discuss health management and why she made the decision to leave the classroom.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. So the title of this episode, such as it is taken from a message I got from a fellow type 1 diabetic teacher, a head teacher, actually, who goes by Head for Happiness. And she said at the end of our message exchange, "My body is a total shell of lies." That is, I think, how all of us with invisible disabilities, hidden chronic illnesses feel, like our bodies are a total shell of lies. So, like every superhero with a shell of lies, I should give you an origin story. So my origin story for my chronic illness slash hidden disability begins in Philadelphia in 2003, like so many of my good stories, including one I won't tell you here, the time I was held up at gunpoint opposite West Philadelphia High School. Yes, that would be the one from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So I'm 20 weeks pregnant. It's Philadelphia. It's 2003. It's a very unlikely pregnancy, and things have started to go badly wrong, though I don't realize it. The skin around my eyes has gone gray and started pulling back into its sockets because I'm profoundly dehydrated. My mouth is so dry that I'm using a washcloth to separate my lips and gums because they stick together so badly. I can't sleep for more than 15 minutes without needing to urinate. There's a big feature of undiagnosed diabetes is needing to urinate constantly. Not pleasant, but definitely the main feature. I'm very close to death, and I have no idea. In fact, I've gone into diabetic ketoacidosis, and that's the condition that killed every type 1 diabetic, every single type 1 diabetic in history, until Canadian Frederick Banting extracted insulin into a 15-year-old in 1922. Diabetic ketoacidosis, just to explain that, so you know if I die suddenly on air what I die of, it's a lack of insulin in the body, which results in the body breaking down fat for sugar. So basically, insulin converts sugar that you consume into glucose that sends it to your muscles so that you have, and brain, so you have energy to do stuff. When you don't have insulin, the sugar just builds up. And so your body is desperate for sugar and yet also profoundly sugary. It's a conundrum. And so it starts breaking down the rest of your body to get energy to live. But as anyone who's ever done the Atkins diet knows, when you start breaking down fat, you produce ketones. So when your body is catastrophically breaking down an enormous amount of fat, you have an enormous amount of ketones, and they build up and they build up, until enough of your blood has been replaced with, and this is the fun part, quite literally nail varnish remover, acetone, at which point your organs fail catastrophically. Oh, but before that, your breath has an enjoyable nail varnish remover smell, which, yeah, now you know. So the night before I took myself to hospital, I was at a supermarket where I opened and drank 3 bottles of fruit juice, used the bathroom twice, and filled the cart with everything sweet I saw before I'd reached the frozen food aisle. And the next day, I called the hospital myself. It was Saturday. The nurses thought I was neurotic, but I rode down on the bus anyway to the Children's Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, the appropriately named CHOP. And my forehead was resting on the metal frame of the seat all the way there. My hands were on my pregnant belly. Pam's going to be joining us in 10 minutes. So Pam, I'll let you in then. I'm just going to finish my drama story because this is my moment in the sun. So sat in the corridor at CHOP while a very skeptical nurse tested my blood. No one trusts pregnant women at all, ever. They just assume that we're talking nonsense. I closed my eyes and then people started running. It was a beautiful scene of validation and also terrifying death. So my blood glucose turned out to be 64, which would be very impressive if you understood how spectacularly incompatible with life that is. And I slipped gracefully, of course, into a coma and early labour. When I woke up, both I and the pregnancy had survived. We had a 50-50 chance, but we both made it. And I was diabetic forever. I like to tell my child that they gave me the diabetes, and they like to say sorry a lot. So, yeah, now I've got diabetes, type 1 diabetes. And for me, it was very manageable until I hit my 40s. And suddenly the shift in hormones meant that it became really rather unmanageable. And that coincided with me entering the teaching profession. So every single one of my lessons at the beginning of the year begins with what I'm going to do now, which is the script for understanding what to do if you have a type 1 diabetic teacher. Now, I've got an enormous amount of comments from people about different chronic illnesses and invisible disabilities. Most of the time, people do not want to disclose to their students, for very good reason. With type 1 diabetes, you have to, because especially if you have excitingly uncontrolled type 1 diabetes, because it can go very badly wrong very quickly with a room full of 30 hostile year 9 staring at you, which is always a fun experience. So at the beginning of the class, it starts like this. I say, I have type 1 diabetes. Can anyone tell us what that is? Now, I should point out that if they've got to key stage 4, they should know by now, but quite often they don't. So it's actually, you know, part of the curriculum. So at least 2 or 3 students have grandparents, inevitably, with type 2 diabetes, who've now progressed on to type 1 diabetes, to insulin dependence, so they can kind of give us a thing. Some of them will have diabetic pets. I just have to say, for every type 1 out there, this is what we don't want you to say when we tell you that we're insulin dependent. Oh, I had a cat with diabetes. All of you had cats with diabetes. I don't know how this is possible. Jasmine is asking, did I have gestational diabetes that turned into type 1? It's a bit tricky. Basically, if you develop diabetes while you're pregnant, they call it gestational diabetes, no matter what type of diabetes it is. But no, what happened is that which is what happens with all type 1, my immune system decided to attack my pancreas for reasons to be really helpful. What it does, it attacks your islets of Langerhans and destroys the insulin-producing cells there, the islet cells. And exciting point, fact fan, insulin comes from the Latin insula, meaning island, because the cells that produce it in your pancreas are islet cells. No one cares about that but me. I think that's really neat. Neat, ooh, coming over all American. So, yeah, the kids know that. But then I tell them that I'm going to need to test my blood because I can't keep my condition out of the classroom. I'm going to do that now. It used to be I had to stab my finger and draw blood, which was always thrills in the classroom, especially when I licked my finger clean. But now I've got a sensor embedded in my arm, which I'm testing now, just like I do for them. And my blood glucose, everyone, the winner is 6.6, which is fabulous. So hopefully I won't pass out on you or lose my ability to speak. So I do that because I'm a cool cyborg and everyone deserves to have a cool cyborg in their classroom. Then I tell them the next thing, that sometimes the alarm will go off if my blood glucose is either too high or too low. If it's too high, then I might have to inject insulin. And then I need to ask them if any of them are scared of needles. Now, I don't do it in front of them, or have done with some classes in the past. But senior management and I came to the sensible decision that maybe I should stop injecting deadly substances into myself in the middle of classrooms. So I have a carry case and I'll have to step out into the hallway. More dramatically for them is what happens if it goes off when it's too low. So then I ask if anyone knows what to do if someone has a hypo, a low blood sugar episode. And then this is the point where everyone goes wrong, including colleagues. So I like to solicit information so I can disabuse them of that information immediately. Most people think that maybe they should find some medication in my bag and inject me. Don't do that. That will kill me. Please don't do that. My medication makes my blood glucose lower. Often people know biscuits might be involved. Would you like a biscuit, miss? Like, essentially, just leave me alone and go and get a teacher. My favorite thing, the best student answer I ever received was one particularly interesting year 9 girl who said, well, miss, obviously I would take a picture Snapchat it and then go and get another teacher, which made me laugh for about half an hour. Yes, she would have done it too. Monstrous child. Wonderful. Loved her. And then I have to say that I will have delicious snacks throughout my lessons, and I will be eating those delicious snacks throughout my lessons. And the most important thing they should know is that they can't eat my snacks. They're not for you. They're for me. I've got Sudashanka wanting to call in. You've disappeared again. Let's see. Yes, they can't have the snacks, and I'll be eating the snacks. So my blood sugar crashes during lessons. I had an observation on Friday with my head of department because our school has decided to go back to observations. Yay. And halfway through the lesson, my speech started slipping. The kids are all always looking out for when my speech starts slipping, and so are my colleagues and faculty. And he just looked at me, went into the team room and came back with a cake, which was great. So then I ate a cake and continued teaching year 12. Oh, my cat's just joining in there. Just so you know, the cats might join in. So yeah, okay, right. I'm inviting you in, JNUJJ. Well, nope, you've gone again. This calling in thing's not working very well. So like I said, I got lots of comments from people, and I just thought I'd just tell you some nice ones about working with colleagues, because there are a lot of difficulties with working with colleagues that we'll talk about later. But the way we adapt our broken bodies here, let's try it. Let's see. Okay. I've sent you in. Hello? No, can't join now. May call in later. Okay. Miss Padgett English says that she has a deal with the teacher next door that she'll yell timber if one of her joints has given way and she needs assistance to get back off the deck. Yeah, my colleagues frequently keep little bags of jelly babies or whatever, and they listen to me, like I said. And if I start losing my words, or if my spelling is particularly erratic, it's not normally particularly erratic, then yeah, they'll just go, okay. And then this one, user Anonymous, she has some great stories. So we got some, like I said, difficult stories that that she's contributed to. But this one is TAs, forming friendships with TAs with when you've got your chronic illness. And so she said, I'm just going to read you her comments. I've got previous TAs with whom I'm now able to laugh about. That time you carried me out of the classroom and picked up the class when I collapsed in guided reading /science/ during the Martin Luther King video. Or that time we exited the same cubicle in the Deptford KFC at midday like a couple of junkies after making a stop off on the way to casualty. Or that time we were wandering through Camberwell making small talk after a trip in the ambulance and you spotted the ECG sticker on my ankle and we killed ourselves laughing. So having people around you that understand and find it funny is very helpful. But of course, that's relatively easy for those of us with the photogenic type of chronic illnesses. Not everyone has such an easy time. And before I play the news, I'm just going to tell you one anonymous story that was sent to me. So the invisible illness this person have is proctitis, which is causes a need to empty the bowels up to 8 times a day. So obviously, no one wants to tell their class that that's an issue. So unlike me and my kind of fae here, I'll have some sugar, isn't it adorable that Miss has fallen over? There's real issues of dignity and privacy with lots of chronic illnesses. So this person's saying, you know, it means that they don't go on field trips, they don't have lunch at school at all because eating will make it worse. And the school are aware, but at the same time, and like absolutely nothing but praise for the assistant and direct management. But at the same time, not only teachers, but also most of their colleagues aren't aware because it's not something that this person wants others to know. So when they walk in late to class, even though they're at school on the right time, when they walk in late to meetings, even though they got to school at the right time, they're judged. See, with me, I can just say, diabetes, hold up my number. But not all of us are that lucky. Right, let's have a news break.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. A survey from the Social Mobility Foundation has found that students from low-income backgrounds fear they will receive lower grades this summer than their peers. 50% of those surveyed worried they would not be able to appeal the grades awarded by their teachers. In addition, 38% of the students were not confident their grades will reflect their ability. 35% did not have access to reliable broadband during lockdown. And 58% felt that not all parts of the UK had suffered equally in the pandemic. The SMF has called for reassurance that should students need to appeal grades, they can do so free of charge. Scotland is the only nation so far to have made a special dispensation for those who have faced greater disadvantage. The teacher from Batley Grammar School in Yorkshire, who was suspended in March this year pending an investigation into his decision to share an image of the Prophet Muhammad in class, has refused to return to work. Despite being cleared of intentionally causing offence and being asked to resume teaching at the school, the teacher involved remains in hiding as he says he genuinely fears for his life. Two other suspended colleagues have also refused to return to the school due to safety concerns. The three members of staff currently remain on full pay and are being supported by the National Education Union. The Education Policy Institute has updated its figures surrounding catch-up funding for pupils around the world. As it now stands, the proposed spending per pupil is as follows. In Northern Ireland and Scotland, schools will receive £230 per pupil. In England, £310. And in Wales, schools will receive £400 on average per pupil. In comparison globally, schools in the US will receive £1,830 per pupil, and in the Netherlands, the total will be £2,090 per pupil. The new figures reflect the most recent budget announcement from the government. That was your latest Teachers Talk Radio News.
And we're back. Got a tweet in from Zoe Enser, whose son is type 1 diabetic. And she says, which made me laugh because I recognized it instantly, some of the nonsense my son has had to put up with is unreal, including not understanding the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Apparently, he can kickstart his pancreas with the right diet. I cannot tell you how many times people have told me how to cure my diabetes. And is possibly the most irritating thing in the entire world. Every single taxi driver I think I've had for the last 10 years has told me I can cure it with cinnamon or a special diet or a supplement powder is one I got Saturday from just any local health food shop. And not eating as much, doing more exercise. It's like, thanks, mate. I can actually live off chocolate cake if I want to and it will make no difference. In fact, when I was diagnosed and I met a nutritionist, she explained to me how carbohydrate counting works. You know the carbohydrates in your meal. You inject enough insulin to cover them according to the ratio of carbs to insulin you're using. And then Bob's your uncle. You're free to go about your life. So I looked at her with my deep analytic graduate school mind and said, does that mean technically that I could just eat chocolate cake for the rest of my life? And she said, well, as someone teaching you to carbohydrate count, yes. But speaking as a nutritionist, I would advise you against that. So, more from Zoe. It's rife. Don't get me started on people who have mistaken insulin for heroin and those who recoil in horror because he's testing his blood sugar. When I was first diagnosed, we didn't have the little insulin pens, which now just literally look like pens, very short needles. We had vials and then giant proper hypodermic needles, so you did have to get them out and squirt into the air and inject yourself as if it was Pulp Fiction. and you were Uma Thurman bringing yourself back to life in public. I always wanted to be mistaken for injecting heroin because I'm oppositional defiant like that, and I felt like having a scene, but it never happened to me. Used to be my fear growing up, says Seema. So she used to inject herself in the toilets. Yeah, a lot of people inject themselves in toilets. I'm really unashamed about mine. I do it on the tube train, but I am aware that other people have, you know, needle phobias and all kinds of things, and maybe I shouldn't do that, but I refuse to not manage my condition because people are strange. Right, Pam, if you are there, I asked Pam to be here for about 7:15, so that's Dr. Pam Jarvis, who's here to talk to us today. I'm staring hopefully at the screen, hoping she'll appear again. While we are waiting for Pam, and I will cut off as soon as she calls in, I'm going to tell you about something that you may have run across online when talking to people with disabilities or seeing people with invisible disabilities talking to each other, which is Spoon's theory. Forgive me in advance if you know about this, but I know most people don't. It's easy to think in your little online communities that everyone understands the language you're using, but mostly they don't. So sometimes those of us with invisible disabilities call ourselves Spoonies, and it all comes from an analogy that was invented by an internet blogger called Christine Mizrandino in 2003. She has lupus, and she was trying to come up with a way to explain to her friend why it is that she just can't cope with a lot of things, why it is that maybe she's turning down social appointments, why it is that she's just so tired all the time. So Spoon Theory, oh, Pam's here. I'll go back to Spoon Theory in a sec. You try one more time, Pam. We'll get there. Well, I'm going to carry on with Spoon Theory while Pam tries again. Oh. There we go. Pam, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I certainly can.
Oh, excellent.
I was just explaining Spoon's theory and people calling themselves Spoonies. Is that something you do? Is that something you're familiar with?
No, I've been listening to you and I have no story as dramatic as that. You've actually beaten me on the birth story as well, because I had twins and I nearly died, but it was all quick. And so, you know, I can say to them, oh, well, I nearly died having you, you know, so many years ago, but I can't say you made me diabetic forever.
That's incredible. I don't know. You nearly killed me is right up there. I think we can use that over our children forever. So, so what happened? How did you nearly die? Totally irrelevant to this discussion.
I just hemorrhaged and everything got put back in and then I was fine. I was probably, it was probably only 15 minutes that I was on the edge. But
I think 15 minutes of being on the edge of dying is more than enough.
Yeah, I guess so. I never really thought about it that way. But, you know, the usual answer is we can't help. We can't help being born together. You know, it wasn't our fault, which it wasn't.
No, that's very true. I do tell my child that I'm joking. I'm not sure my child always believes me. So do you want to tell us what your chronic illness is?
Invisible? Yes. Yeah. I mean, mine are a mature onset, so I didn't really start with this until I was over 50, and I was trying to think, because I've got sort of three things that bounced around the last kind of, I suppose, 6 years of my career, and one is mature onset diabetes, but I'm not injecting, and it's not that bad. I take one drug and thus far, you know, managed. I mean, some of the sugar levels that you report, my husband's actually an insulin dependent diabetic, and I think you've beaten him, you know.
Yeah, I'm very proud of my 64. But unfortunately, I think there's something like 350,000 type 1s in the country and their loved ones. And so it's only those people who can be impressed with my 64. So thank you for being one of them.
Well, he's nominally type 2, but it all came together with a hyperactive thyroid. So we you know, it's a bit strange because it was very, very full on very quickly. But anyway, I mean, he's not a teacher, so although he would probably have his own work stories to tell you, but some of the, you know, things that you describe are familiar to me, but not happening to me. So the diabetes, basically, it's much less dramatic than you. I'd feel sort of what I call heady. But if I eat properly and I take, you know, the drug that I've been given, I'm fine. Really, the sort of, I suppose, more dramatic things, and they weren't very dramatic, happened to me before I knew I was diabetic. Because it's, you know, it's just very kind of, you just think, oh, I've been sitting here too long or whatever. So, but the issue for me that was problematic was I've got carpal tunnel. I had an operation that sorted it out for a while, but then I think it's about 25% of cases it comes back. But it's slightly different when it comes back because you don't have the pins and needles, or I don't anyway. But the tips of your fingers are quite numb. And I also have an RSI that kind of presented itself at the same time, and that was what caused me the most problem. I've got some arthritis in my knees, but that's not a big deal either. Actually, for work, it was the RSI and the carpal tunnel.
But they all kind of amplify on top of each other, don't they? And I go back to what you said about feeling kind of heady. You know, that's that brain fog that so many of us with chronic illnesses experience, and it has a huge impact. And it's very, very hard to explain because we're standing there looking perfectly normal, but we're not.
Well, for me, it's meetings more than actually being in a classroom, because obviously I spent the last 12 years of my life in HE, and the teaching is different in HE. It's there is an issue which I'll kind of explain, but it's not so much student facing because they're adults and they're a bit more independent. But you know, I mean, meetings is the same across education, that you know, where people will go on and on and on, and I find myself getting more and more sort of I can't concentrate on what you're saying, and then grumpy.
Well, and with type 1 diabetes, basically our bodies do what everybody's bodies do throughout the teaching day, which is you have adrenaline that runs throughout the day. And for us, that pushes our blood glucose up. And then as soon as lessons stop, the adrenaline goes away. And that's exactly when you have the meetings. So at that point, every single meeting I go to, my blood glucose is either crashing or it's so high that I'm falling asleep. So I have lost count of the number of meetings I've fallen asleep in and then had to go to people afterwards and go, look, I'm not rude, I'm disabled. Like, it's just, you know, it's humiliating to have to say that. But as I was saying earlier, at least diabetes, people, you know, people don't have that disgust factor that they, you know, where they treat you as if there's something very, very wrong about you. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was the RSI really, because the marking in HE comes in a huge wodge twice a year, and because of you, this is modular teaching. I think an awful you're saying, oh well, you know, you have to go to the meetings at this time or whatever. But I think all education institutions have this kind of, we work this way. It's very, very rigid. Yeah. You can't do it any other way. Generally speaking, I found anyway that managers are very sympathetic. They're very helpful. But at the end of the day, we have to do the job this way. There's no flexibility.
So, and the kind of flexibility that came in during lockdown, so the fact that you could suddenly attend meetings via Zoom, you could turn your camera off so you could be, you know, lying on the couch and attending a meeting. It would be amazing to retain that kind of adaptability going forward, but it won't happen. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, we can hope, can't we? But for me, I think my Waterloo was the fact that I had all these assignments coming in sort of, as I say, in twice a year after Christmas and then, you know, in the sort of late spring. And there's a set gap between your marking and your exam board, and you have to get that done. And there's a system which used to work, basically, which is, you know, students can get like a week's extension. They don't have to apply for a formal, you know, mitigating circumstances. Well, that's fine if it's like five students or something. But I think because of the way the world works nowadays, we were, you know, you were getting up to a third, and it basically just takes your time. You can't move an exam board. It's not possible. So, you know, you're ending up just pulling, you know, sort of 7 hour days or whatever actually at your computer. And there's, you know, on, and again, you know, when I first started teaching HE, I actually marked papers. But, you know, we don't do it like that anymore. And if you're writing in-text comments in essays, you're clicking the mouse all the time.
Right. And
that was just basically, you know, I couldn't do it at the pace I was being asked to do it at. Now, there are versions of software, and they're just, I think they're getting better all the time, where you can actually speak what you want to put, you know, on the text. But actually in-text comments that I found, because we investigated all sorts of things, it's really, really difficult. And in-text comments are really, really important to students. Mm-hmm. So that was really my issue. And I mean, I can see in my head all sorts of ways where we wouldn't have to mark like that if you did, you know, sort of other ways of doing it. But that's, you can't do that. And it's set in stone and you can't do
it. Yeah,
that's all over education. It's different systems, but they're all set in stone.
Yeah, no, absolutely fascinating. And you're absolutely right. I think the school day, everything about schools and systems is set in stone from the sort of institutional working practices of meetings, but also just to the actual school day, whether you're FE or early years, you know, there's no getting around the fact that you're required to be in situ, in place for X amount of time. Later on, I'm going to be reading some words from the type 1 diabetic teacher who I stole the title of this show from, who said that actually being a head teacher has made it much easier because she now has much more flexibility, which I was not expecting. I was very, very surprised by that. But essentially, because she can, you know, just adapt what she's doing around the impact of what's happened with her blood glucose or with her rheumatoid arthritis, whereas in the classroom there's no flexibility. Someone's written in to say brain fog, losing your words during lessons, crashing at the end of the day, they're all completely familiar, having to come out of you know, lessons in the middle of the day, because as much as everyone tries to adapt for us, timetables are timetables, and you know, you end up with five period days, you end up with a twilight lesson at the end so you can teach your class. And yeah,
Had I been an early years teacher, you see, I think the arthritis in my knees would have been more problematic. And I had a colleague long time ago when I worked in FE. She was a deputy head in a small primary school, but she had a, you know, pretty big teaching load. She was early years, and she actually had to give up because she couldn't do it. She couldn't do the, you know, the moving down and sitting in small chairs and this kind of thing. And she was nowhere near retirement. And this was how we met, because she took a job teaching childhood studies in FE. She was earning a wage that was, you know, massively below what she'd been earning. So it had that kind of effect on her career.
A lot of people, one of the people who sent me messages has moved to supply teaching away from, you know, a full-time contracted position so that she can contract the hours of her day. And I know a lot of people who've moved into being teaching assistants instead, again, to sort of arrange mobility issues and responsibilities around their conditions.
I'm quite interested that you, you know, you have to tell your students.
Well, it's because my blood glucose is so unstable. Yeah. This is just a side rant, but no one studies women's bodies, or it's not so much the biological status of being female as female hormone patterns. So for 2 weeks out of the month, my insulin resistance is completely different. And as I approach menopause, that gets more and more unbalanced. And no one's done any studies on women's bodies. So no one has a solution. My endocrinologist's solution is simply, you'll be menopausal soon. It's like, mate, I'm 49. It could be a while yet. And that means that my blood sugar will crash in lessons. my blood sugar will go too high for safety in lessons. I need to act on it instantly when it goes low because it's an emergency situation. I have had an ambulance called out before for being, you know, below one, essentially.
When I studied sociology, actually, and this is a long time ago, one of the topics I did was the fact that the man's body was standard and the, you know, the woman's body was, you know, sort of different. And so, I mean, it's incredible. We're sitting here in 2021 and you're telling me the same thing.
Well, there was that book that came out last year, I think, that looked at all the ways in which men's bodies have been done as the default. And one of them was stab vests, which are just designed for men's bodies.
Yes.
Yeah. Just shocking. But that's a side note. But we talked about occupational health assessments, which are supposed to be the way around this. Yeah.
Now, I thought mine was pretty good. As I say, I didn't really have much problem in management. I had one boss who wasn't really helpful, and that was, I think, for less than a year. You know, they had issues with other people, and it just basically got dealt with. I found Occi Health quite helpful, and most of what they asked for that could be done was done, if you see what I mean. But it was the rigidity of the system, as I said before, that was a problem for me, not actually a person or something like that. I know people have got sort of horrendous boss stories, but I haven't got one of those. For me, you asked before we did this, did I have any particular crisis? And I mean, you've got me well beat there, right? You know, but one I sort of remember is that I had a designated break in my teaching sessions, and that was for me to, you know, get a drink and, you know, get something to eat if I need to, that kind of thing. And we used to get students coming up if we said, okay, so we're going for a break. It's a 15-minute break. There's no bells ringing or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, it fits in your particular set session. And these two came up and said, oh, can we talk about the assignment? And I said, no, because there's the break and I have to go off and do something in the break. And I didn't sort of say what it was.
Yeah.
And then I found out that they'd actually complained to the course leader and said this was extremely inconvenient, and they had to get off directly after the session. And there was no fallout for me, and I think they were told, you know. But that, you know, I was talking to a colleague about it, and they said, well, maybe you should tell the group you're diabetic. And the sort of, I wasn't expecting that. It was just more of a sort of quick emotional reaction from me. And I thought, I just said to my colleague, well, why should I have to do that?
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that just because I, you know, I didn't see that I should have to, that they'd all go, oh, yeah, she's diabetic, you know, this type of thing. And actually, you know, in keeping with the Equality Act, you shouldn't have to. And I get maybe you have to because of, you know, to various safety safeguarding. I get that. But actually,
add in, this is a great username, by the way, Anony Mouse's story. She's got Crohn's disease. And so therefore what she's done is shift from a leadership position down to supply teaching so that she can compact all her hours. This is a great username, by the way, Anony Mouse's story. She's got Crohn's disease. And so therefore what she's done is shift from a leadership position down to supply teaching so that she can compact all her hours, teach throughout the day, she doesn't take breaks, and then she can leave and eat afterwards. So I'll just read what she's written. Just before COVID, I was working in a year two classroom. My TA sat me down one lunchtime to explain in great detail how disappointing it was that I didn't join them in the staff room at lunchtime. I was so blindsided that I listened in silence and pointed out why I worked the way I did. I also pointed out that our conversation meant I hadn't taken my medication and that I'd have to stay behind after school to catch up on the marking. and our working relationship never recovered, which I think speaks directly to a couple of things you've just said there. Number one, that it doesn't matter if there were no repercussions from those students complaining about you. That's still, that's quite a big emotional blow to have something like that happen, both in your relationship with the class and in general, your perception of yourself as a teacher. But also that need to disclose that, that forced by the situation is, you're right. You're not required to, you're protected from doing it, but B, it's undignified violation of your privacy.
Well, the thing I think as well, I mean, from working with students, and I think probably the same thing goes for parents, if you've been doing a teaching younger people. One of the things, you know, I came to thinking was, well, maybe these students had to go off right on the dot to get to work. I mean, I've taught students who basically work a full hour week in between, you know, doing their degree. And I'm talking about full-time students here at universities, because that's the only way they can survive. I've taught students who've been parents and single parents who have to get off to